Chapter 18. The Heritage of the Desert. Mescal's far out in front by this time. Depend on it, Hare, went on Nob. That trick was the cunning Indian of her. She'll ride Silvermane into White Sage tomorrow. Then she'll hide from Snap. The bishop will take care of her. She'll be safe for the present in White Sage. Now we must bury these men. Tomorrow, my son. Then, what then? Hare straightened up. Unutterable pain darkened the flame in the Mormon's gaze. For an instant his face worked spasmodically, only to stiffen into a stony mask. It was the old conflict once more, the never-ending war between flesh and spirit. And now the flesh had prevailed. The time has come, said George Knob. Yes, replied his father, harshly. A great calm settled over Hare, his blood ceased to race, his mind to riot. In August Knob's momentous word he knew the old man had found himself. At last he had learned the lesson of the desert, to strike first and hard. Zeke, hitch up a team, said August Knob. No, wait a moment. Here comes Piaut. Let's hear what he has to say. Piaut appeared on the zigzag cliff trail, driving a burro at dangerous speed. He sighted Silvermane and the rustlers, suggested George, as the shepherd approached. Knob translated the excited Indian's mingling of Navajo and Piaut languages to mean just what George had said. Snap ahead of riders, Silvermane far, far ahead of Snap, running fast, damn. Mescal's pushing him hard to make the sand strip, said George. Piaut, three fires tonight, lookout point. This order meant the execution of August Knob's hurry signal for the Navajos, and after he had given it, he waved the Indian toward the cliff, and lapsed into a silence, which no one dared to break. Knob consigned the bodies of the rustlers to the famous cemetery under the red wall. He laid Dean in grave 31. It was the grave that the outlaw had promised as the last resting place of Dean's spy. Chance and Culver he buried together. It was noteworthy that no Mormon rites were conferred on Culver, once a Mormon in good standing, nor were any prayers spoken over the open graves. What did August Knob intend to do? That was the question in Hare's mind, as he left the house. It was a silent day, warm as summer, though the sun was overcast with gray clouds, the birds were quiet in the trees, there was no bray of burro or clarion call of peacock, even the hum of the river had fallen into silence. Hare wandered over the farm and down the red lane, brooding over the issue. Knob's few words had been full of meaning, the cold gloom so foreign to his nature had been even more impressive. His had been the revolt of the meek. The gentle, the loving, the administering, the spiritual uses of his life had failed. Hare recalled what the desert had done to his own nature, how it had bred in him its impulse to fight, to resist, to survive. If he, a stranger of a few years, could be molded in the flaming furnace of its fiery life, what then must be the cast of August Knob, born on the desert, and sleeping 5 nights out of 7 on the sands for 60 years? The desert. Hare trembled as he grasped all its meaning. Then he slowly resolved that meaning. There were the measureless distances, to narrow the eye and teach restraint, the untrodden trails, the shifting sands, the thorny breaks, the broken lava to pierce the flesh, the heights and depths, unscalable and unplumbed. And over all the sun, red and burning. The parched plants of the desert fought for life, growing far apart, sending enormous roots deep to pierce the sand and split the rock for moisture, arming every leaf with a barbed thorn or poison sap, never thriving and ever thirsting. The creatures of the desert endured the sun and lived without water, and were at endless war. The hawk had a keener eye than his fellow of more fruitful lands, sharper beak, greater spread of wings, and claws of deeper curve. For him there was little to eat, a rabbit now, a rock rat then, nature made his swoop like lightning and it never missed its aim. Their god wolf never failed in a sure scent, in a silent hunt. The lizard flicked an invisible tongue into the heart of a flower, and the bee he caught stung with a poison sting. The battle of life went to the strong. So the desert trained each of its wild things to survive. No eye of the desert but burned with the flame of the sun. To kill or to escape death, it was the dominant motive. To fight barrenness and heat, It was stern enough, but each creature must fight his fellow. What then of the men, who drifted into the desert and survived? They must of necessity endure the wind and heat, the drought and famine, they must grow lean and hard, keen-eyed and silent. The weak, the humble, the sacrificing must be winnowed from among them. As each man developed he took on some aspect of the desert. Holderness had the amber clearness of its distances in his eyes, its deceit in his soul, August Knob, the magnificence of the desert pine in his giant form, its strength in his heart, Snap Knob, the cast of the hawk beak in his face, its cruelty in his nature. But all shared alike in the common element of survival, ferocity. August Knob had subdued his to the promptings of a Christ-like spirit, yet did not his very energy, his wonderful tirelessness, his will to achieve, his power to resist, partake of that fierceness? Moreover, after many struggles, he too had been overcome by the desert's call for blood. His mystery was no longer a mystery. Always in those moments of revelation which he disclaimed, he had seen himself as faithful to the desert in the end. Hare's slumbers that night were broken. He dreamed of a great gray horse leaping in the sky from cloud to cloud with the lightning and the thunder under his hoofs, the storm winds sweeping from his silver mane. He dreamed of Mescal's brooding eyes. They were dark gateways of the desert open only to him, and he entered to chase the alluring stars deep into the purple distance. He dreamed of himself waiting in serene confidence for some unknown thing to pass. He awakened late in the morning and found the house hushed. The day wore on in a repose unstirred by breeze and sound, in accord with the morning of August Knob. At noon a solemn procession wended its slow course to the shadow of the red cliff, and as solemnly returned. Then a long-drawn piercing Indian whoop broke the midday hush. It heralded the approach of the Navajos. In single file they rode up the lane, and when the falcon-eyed Estwal dismounted before his white friend, the line of his warriors still turned the corner of the red wall. Next to the chieftain rode Scarbreast, the grim warlord of the Navajos. His followers trailed into the grove. Their sinewy bronze bodies, almost naked, glistened wet from the river. Full 100 strong were they, a silent, lean-limbed desert troop. The white prophet's fires burn bright, said the chieftain. Estwal is here. The Navajo is a friend, replied Knob. The white man needs counsel and help. He has fallen upon evil days. Estwal sees war in the eyes of his friend. War, chief, war. Let the Navajo and his warriors rest and eat. Then we shall speak. A single command from the Navajo broke the waiting files of warriors. Mustangs were turned into the fields, packs were unstrapped from the burrows, blankets spread under the cottonwoods. When the afternoon waned and the shade from the western wall crept into the oasis, August Knob came from his cabin clad in buckskins, with a large blue colt swinging handle outward from his left hip. He ordered his sons to replenish the fire, which had been built in a circle, and when the fierce-eyed Indians gathered round the blaze he called to his women, to bring meat and drink. Hare's unnatural calmness had prevailed until he saw Knob stride out, to front the waiting Indians. Then a ripple of cold passed over him. He leaned against a tree in the shadow, and watched the gray-faced giant stalking to and fro before his Indian friends. Along, while he strode in the circle of light to pause at length, before the chieftains and to break the impressive silence with his deep voice. Estwal sees before him a friend stung to his heart. Men of his own color have long injured him, yet have lived. The Mormon loved his fellows and forgave. 5 sons he laid in their graves, yet his heart was not hardened. His firstborn went the trail of the fire water, and is an outcast from his people. Many enemies has he and one is a chief. He has killed the white man's friends, stolen his cattle, and his water. Today the white man laid another son in his grave. What thinks the chief? Would he not crush the scorpion that stung him? The old Navajo answered in speech which, when translated, was as stately as the Mormon's. Estwal respects his friend, but he has not thought him wise. The white prophet sees visions of things to come, but his blood is cold. He asks too much of the white man's God. He's a chief, he has an eye like the lightning, an arm strong as the pine, yet he has not struck. Estwal grieves. he does not wish to shed blood for pleasure. But Estlaw's friend has let too many selfish men cross his range and drink at his springs. Only a few can live on the desert. Let him who has found the springs and the trails keep them for his own. Let him who came too late go away to find for himself, to prove himself a warrior, or let his bones whiten in the sand. The Navajo counsels his white friend to kill. The great Estlaw speaks wise words, said Nob. The white prophet is richer for them. He will lay aside the prayers to his unseen God, and will seek his foe. It is well. The white man's foe is strong, went on the Mormon. He has many men, they will fight. If Estlaw sends his braves with his friend there will be war. Many braves will fall. The white prophet wishes to save them if he can. He will go forth alone to kill his foe. If the sun sets four times and the white man is not here, then Estlaw will send his great war chief and his warriors. They will kill whom they find at the white man's springs. And thereafter half of all the white man's cattle that were stolen shall be Estlaw's, so that he watch over the water and range. Estlaw greets a chief, answered the Indian. The white prophet knows he will kill his enemy, but he is not sure he will return. He is not sure that the little braves of his foe will fly like the winds, yet he hopes. So he holds the Navajo back to the last. Estlaw will watch the sun set four times. If his white friend returns he will rejoice. If he does not return the Navajo will send his warriors on the trail. August Nob walked swiftly from the circle of light into the darkness, his heavy steps sounded on the porch, and in the hallway. His three sons went toward their cabins with bowed heads and silent tongues. Estlaw folded his blanket about him, and stalked off into the gloom of the grove, followed by his warriors. Hare remained in the shadow of the cottonwood, where he had stood unnoticed. He had not moved a muscle, since he had heard August Nob's declaration. That one word of Nob's intention, alone, had arrested him. For it had struck into his heart and mind. It had paralyzed him with the revelation it brought, for Hare now knew as he had never known anything before, that he would forestall August Nob, avenge the death of Dave, and kill the rustler Holderness. Through blinding shock he passed slowly into cold acceptance of his heritage from the desert. The 2 long years of his desert training were as an open page to Hare's unveiled eyes. The life he owed to August Nob, the strength built up by the old man's knowledge of the healing power of plateau and range, these lay in a long curve between the day Nob had lifted him out of the White Sage Trail and this day of the Mormon's extremity. A long curve with Holderness's insulting blow at the beginning, his murder of a beloved friend at the end. For Hare remembered the blow, and never would he forget Dave's last words. Yet unforgettable as these were, it was duty rather than revenge that called him. This was August Nob's hour of need. Hare knew himself to be the tool of inscrutable fate, he was the one to fight the old desert-scarred Mormon's battle. Hare recalled how humbly he had expressed his gratitude to Nob, and the apparent impossibility of ever repaying him, and then Nob's reply, "Lad, you can never tell how one man may repay another." Hare could pay his own debt and that of the many wanderers, who had drifted across the sands, to find a home with the Mormon. These men stirred in their graves, and from out the shadow of the cliff whispered the voice of Mescal's nameless father, "Is there no one to rise up for this old hero of the desert?" Softly Hare slipped into his room. Putting on coat and belt, and catching up his rifle he stole out again stealthily, like an Indian. In the darkness of the wagon shed he felt for his saddle, and finding it, he groped with eager hands for the grain box, raising the lid he filled a measure with grain, and emptied it into his saddle bag. Then lifting the saddle he carried it out of the yard, through the gate and across the lane to the corrals. The wilder mustangs in the far corral began to kick and snort, and those in the corral, where Black Bolly was kept, trooped noisily to the bars. Bolly whinnied and thrust her black muzzle over the fence. Hare placed a caressing hand on her while he waited, listening and watching. It was not unusual for the mustangs to get restless at any time, and Hare was confident that this would pass without investigation. Gradually the restless stampings and suspicious snorting ceased, and Hare, letting down the bars, led Bolly out into the lane. It was the work of a moment to saddle her, His bridle hung where he always kept it, on the pommel, and with nimble fingers he shortened the several straps to fit Bowley's head, and slipped the bit between her teeth. Then he put up the bars of the gate. Before mounting he stood a moment thinking coolly, deliberately numbering the several necessities he must not forget: grain for Bowley, food for himself, his Colt and Winchester, cartridges, canteen, matches, knife. He inserted a hand into one of the saddle bags expecting to find some strips of meat. The bag was empty. He felt in the other one, and under the grain he found what he sought. The canteen lay in the coil of his lasso tied to the saddle, and its heavy canvas covering was damp to his touch. With it he thrust the long Winchester into its saddle sheath, and swung his leg over the Mustang. The house of the Nubs was dark and still. The dying council fire cast flickering shadows under the black cottonwoods where the Navajos slept. The faint breeze that rustled the leaves brought the low sullen roar of the river. Hare guided Bowley into the thick dust of the lane, laid the bridle loosely on her neck for her to choose the trail, and silently rode out into the lonely desert night.